Now Bork Castle will be an excellent day trip out of Gdansk. Catching the train right out of the main train station, it'd take less than an hour to go the distance. And trains leave the Gwovny about every 35 to 40 minutes. There's one it leaves at 8:03 that will get me in there at 8:45. So once I get my ticket, get boarded onto the train, then come back with the narration and let's learn some history about Pomerania and the castle at Malbork. The northwestern part of Poland, known as Pomerania or Pomorze, has nothing to do with the little dogs. One of its best sites is Malbork Castle, the biggest Gothic castle in Europe and one of the most interesting castles in Eastern Europe. Malbork Castle is soaked in history. The biggest brick castle in the world, the largest castle of the Gothic period, and one of Europe's most imposing fortresses. It sits smugly on a marshy plain at the edge of town in Malbork, 35 miles southeast of Gdansk. This was the headquarters of the notorious Teutonic Knights, a Germanic band of ex-crusaders who dominated northern Poland in the Middle Ages. When the Teutonic Knights were invited to Polish lands to convert neighboring pagans in the 13th century, they found the perfect site for their new capital here on the bank of the Nogat River. Construction began in 1274. After the Teutonic Knights conquered Gdansk in 1308, the order moved its official headquarters from Venice to Malbork, where they remained for nearly 150 years. They called the castle Marienborg, or the Castle of Mary, in honor of the order's patron saint. What about the Teutonic Knights? The order of the Teutonic Knights began in the Holy Land in 1191 during the Third Crusade, officially called the Order of the Hospital of the Blessed Virgin Mary of the German House of Jerusalem. These German monks and knights took vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience. They also built hospitals and cared for injured knights. When the Crusades ended in the 12th century, the order found itself out of a job and went back to Europe. They set up shop in Venice and reorganized as a chivalric order of Christian mercenaries, pagan killers for hire. The Teutonic Knights were hired in 1226 for a gig in northern Poland, where the Duke asked them to subdue a tribe of pagans who had been attacking his lands. The Teutonic Knights, claiming to be missionaries and wearing white clothes decorated with black crosses, spent 60 years saving the pagans by turning them into serfs or brutally massacring them. Like house guests who didn't know when to leave, the Teutonic Knights decided they enjoyed northern Poland and stuck around. The Knights made themselves at home, building one of Europe's biggest and most imposing fortresses, Malbork. Because they were fanatical Christians, they won the support of the Pope and the Holy Roman Emperor. When the Teutonic Knights seized large parts of northern Poland in 1308, including Gdansk, cutting off Polish access to the Baltic Sea, the Polish royals began to realize their mistake. The Teutonic Knights invited more Germans to come join them, building their numbers and tightening their grasp on the region. They grew rich from Hanseatic trade, specializing in amber, grain, and timber. The Knights conquered Estonia and Latvia and began to threaten the Poles' pagan neighbor to the east, Lithuania. By the late 14th century, the Teutonic Knights were enjoying a golden age at the expense of the Poles and Lithuanians. At about this time, Poland's long-lived Pius dynasty died out. Inspired by a mutual desire to fight back against the Teutonic Knights, the Poles and the Lithuanians decided to join their kingdoms. In 1386, Polish Princess Jadwiga married Lithuanian Prince Vladislav Jagiello, who converted to Christianity for the occasion, and uniting Poland and Lithuania and kickstarting a grand new dynasty, the Jagiellonians. Just as every American knows the date of July 4, 1776, every Pole knows the date July 15, 1410, the Battle of Grunwald. King Wenceslaw and Grand Duke Witautas the Great led a ragtag army of some 40,000 soldiers, Lithuanians, Poles, and other Slavs, and even speedy Tartar horsemen against 27,000 Teutonic knights. At the end of the day, some 18,000 Poles and Lithuanians were dead, but so were half of the Teutonic knights, and the other half had been captured. Poland and Lithuania were victorious. Though the Teutonic Knights remained in Poland, extending their Germanic cultural influence on the region well into the 20th century, their political power waned. They pulled out of Lithuania, and they once again allowed free trade on the Vistula. A generation later, the 13 Years' War from 1454 to 1466 finally put an end to the Teutonic Knights' domination of northern Poland. The order officially dissolved in 1575 when they converted to Protestants, though some conspiracy theories claim the Teutonic Knights are still very much active. The Knights' influence on Poland persists today, even beyond the striking red brick churches and castles scattered around the northern part of the country. The Polish novelist Sienkiewicz, The Teutonic Knights, is a cultural benchmark and a favorite work of many Poles. The 19th century romantics who fanned the flames of Polish patriotism turned the Teutonic Knights into a symbol of German oppression. Even today, Poles and all Slavs think of the Teutonic Knights as murderous invaders, while the Germans see them as a mere footnote in their history. At its peak in the early 1400s, Malbork was both the imposing home of a seemingly unstoppable army and Europe's final bastion of chivalric ideals. Surrounded by swamplands with only one gate in need of defense, it was a tough nut to crack. Malbork was never taken by force in the Middle Ages, though it had to withstand various sieges by the Poles during the 13 Years' War, including a campaign that lasted over 3 years. Finally, in 1457, the Polish king gained control of Malbork by buying off Czech mercenaries guarding the castle. Malbork became a Polish royal residence for 300 years. But when Poland was partitioned in the late 18th century, this region went back into German hands. The castle became a barracks. Windows were sealed up. Delicate vaulting was damaged, bricks were quarried for new buildings, and Malbork deteriorated. In the late 19th century, Romantic German artists and poets rediscovered the place. An architect named Konrad Steinbrecht devoted 40 years of his life to Malbork, painstakingly restoring the palace to its medieval splendor. A half century later, the Nazis used the castle to house POWs, and about half of it was destroyed by the Soviets, who saw it as a symbol of long-standing German domination. But it was restored again, and today Malbork has been returned to its Teutonic glory. Coming by train from Gdansk, I'll enjoy views of the castle on my right as I cross the Nogat River. To get from the station to the castle, it's about a 15-minute walk. I could leave the station to the right, walk straight, and go through the pedestrian underpass beneath the busy road by the red staircase. When I emerge on the other side, I'll follow the busy road with occasional views on my right of the castle's main tower. And I'll take my first right turn onto Kościuszki, the main shopping street. On Kościuszki, I'll pass the fancy pink building housing the TI on the right. Near the bottom of Kościuszki, at the fountain and the McDonald's, I'll jog right, then bear left over two moats. I turn right and follow the castle wall to the inn, where I'll find the ticket office. Castle entry is 35 zlotys. The photography on the ground is free. If I want to take pictures inside the buildings, it's an additional 15 zlotys. I'm technically required to enter the castle with a 3-hour tour or audio guide, Polish version included in my ticket. But most non-Polish speakers simply split off from their guide and tour the place on their own. Brit Steve says, just enter with any tour, wander off, and explore the castle using the self-guided tour. English tours only run about 3 times a day, likely starting about 11 o'clock. Private tours were about 210 zloty, but Steve's recommends checking if there is an English-speaking guide available. Then take the initiative to kind of get a group of frustrated English speakers by the cashier, and thus bringing the per-person cost down on the tour. The official tour of Melbourne lasts about 3 hours, and while there's plenty to see, Rick's self-guided tour allows me to see the highlights at my own pace. Remember, I can split off from the group at any time. This tour also works if I'm tagging along with the Polish group, since it corresponds more or less to the route most Melbourne guides take. Still, every guide is a little different and exhibits can be moved around. The castle complex is a bit of a maze with various entrances and exits for each room, often behind closed but unlocked doors. So don't be shy about grabbing a medieval doorknob and letting myself in. Pause the narrative here, and once I enter the castle, if I'm able to tour it on my own, then begin again once I'm inside the gate. Stand in front of the gate to one of Europe's most intimidating fortresses, home to the Grand Master, monks, and knights of the Teutonic Order. Across from the gate is the lower castle, which was an infirmary and hospital for injured knights and retirees. The inn closest to me is the Chapel of St. Lawrence. Farther away, the former farm buildings have been converted into hotel rooms and restaurants. Go up the wooden drawbridge. Above the door to the brick gate is a sculpture of St. Mary with the baby Jesus next to a shield and helmet. The two messages to visitors: this castle is protected by Mary, and the Teutonic Knights are here to convert pagans by force if necessary, or, as it turned out, even if not necessary. Pass through this gate into the entry area. Imagine the gate behind you closing. You look up to see wooden chutes where archers are preparing to rain arrows down on you. Your last thought: maybe we should have left the Teutonic Knights alone after all. Before I'm pierced by arrows, read the castle's history into its walls. The foundation is made of huge stones, which are rare in these marshy lands. They were brought from Sweden. But most of the castle, like so many other buildings in northern Poland, was built with handmade red brick. Throughout the castle, the darker colored, rougher brick is original, and the lighter colored, smoother brick was used for restoration in the 19th century and again after World War II. I'll venture through 2 more enclosed spaces, watching for the holes in the wall for more guards and soldiers. The Teutonic Knights connected nearby lakes to create a system of canals, forming a moat around the castle that could be crossed only by this drawbridge. Ponder the fact that I have to go through 5 separate, well-defended gates to reach the middle castle. This part of Melbourne, built at an uphill incline to make it even more imposing, was designed to impress knights and monks lived here. Let's get oriented. To your left is the east wing, where guests would sleep. Today, this houses the amber collection on the ground floor and the armory upstairs. To the right, or west, as I enter the main courtyard, is the Grand Refectory, close to the entrance, and the Grand Master's Palace, the taller, square building at the far end. Enter the ground floor of the building on my left. And remember, I don't need to be shy about opening closed doors. And there is the Amber Collection. This exhibit will make jewelry shoppers salivate, even as someone with zero interest in amber, as I have been. Begin at the huge chunks of raw amber and the illuminated display of inclusions, bugs stuck in the amber a la Jurassic Park. Some of the ancient amber artifacts displayed here are up to 3,000 years old. These were found in graves put there by people who thought amber would help the deceased into a better world. Wandering the hall, I'll see all manner of amber creations. Meanwhile, let's learn a little bit about amber. Poland's Baltic seaside is known as the Amber Coast. I can see amber in Gdansk Amber Museum. I saw it all through Latvia and Estonia, in the collection at Melbourne Castle, and in shop windows everywhere. This fossilized tree resin originated here on the north coast of Poland 40 million years ago. It comes in as many different colors as Eskimo have words for snow. 300 distinct shades, from yellowish white to yellowish black, from opaque to transparent. Darker colored amber is generally mixed with ash and sand, making it more fragile and generally less desirable. Lighter amber is mixed with gases and air bubbles. Amber has been popular since long before there were souvenir stands. Archaeologists have found graves of Roman citizens and their coins who were buried with crosses made of amber. Almost 75% of the world's amber is mined in northern Poland, and it often simply washes up on the beaches after a winter storm. Some of the elaborate amber sculptures displayed at the museums are created by joining pieces of amber with amber glue, made of melted down amber mixed with an adhesive agent. More recently, amber craftsmen are combining amber with silver to create artwork, a method dubbed the Polish School. In addition to being good for the economy, some Poles believe amber is good for their health. A traditional cure for arthritis pain is to pour strong vodka over amber, let it set, and then rub it on sore joints. Other remedies call for mixing amber dust with honey or rose oil. It sounds superstitious, but it works. Amber contains a mineral that actually can help certain health problems. In this museum are boxes, brooches, necklaces, chess sets, pipes, miniature ships, wine glasses, belts for skinny-waisted, fashion-conscious women. Look for two truly exquisite pieces, a small casket and an altar. Many of the finely decorated jewelry boxes and chests have ivory, silver, or shell inlays, better for contrast than gold. The portable religious shrines and altars could be used for travel, allowing people to remain reverent on the road and still pack light. Find the amber crucifix. This is a small replica of a 6-foot-tall amber and silver cross presented to Pope John Paul II by the people of Gdansk. Another display case contains necklaces displaying the full range of amber colors, from opaque white at the top to transparent yellow in the middle, to virtually black at the bottom. Once through here, go back outside and turn left to the wooden staircase above the Gothic Cafe. Worth considering for a meal. Go up that staircase and several more inside to the top floor. And there is the armory. I can browse my way through the impressive array of swords, armor, and other armaments, and it does have English descriptions. I can look for the 600-year-old hand-and-a-half swords, too big to be held in one hand. At the end, in the display of cannons, pikes, and spears, Look for the giant shield. These shields could be lined up to form a portable wall to protect the knights. Head downstairs to the second room of the armory, displaying suits of armor, including one for horses. On the wall behind the first suit of armor, look for some 5-foot-long two-hand swords, even bigger than the ones upstairs. Halfway down the hall on the left, find the suit of armor from the hussars, Polish horseback knights, who had wings on their armor, which created a terrifying sound when galloping. From here, head back outside and cross the main courtyard, entering the smaller courtyard through the passage next to the dark wood top tower. There, I'll find the steep steps down into the boiler room. Begin again when I reach this spot. The Teutonic Knights had a surprisingly sophisticated method for heating this huge complex. I can see a furnace down below and a sort of a holding area for superheated rocks up above. The radiant heat given off by the rocks spread through the vents without also filling them with smoke. This is one of the 11 such boiler rooms in the castle complex. As I tour the rest of the castle, I can keep an eye out for little saucer-sized vents in the floor where the heat came through. Now, I'll head back up into the main courtyard and turn right, going uphill about 30 yards. At the upper part of this castle are two doors. Take the one on the right, then climb up the stairs into the Grand Master's Palace. The Grand Master's Palace was one of the grandest royal residences in medieval Europe, used in later times by Polish kings and German kaisers. From the top of the stairs, head down the hall to the right. Notice the troughs in the ground. Anyone wanting an audience with the Grand Master had to wash both his hands and his feet. At the end of the hall, on the left, enter the elegant summer refectory. This was where the Grand Master dined. With big stained glass windows and all of the delicate vaulting supported by a single pillar in the middle, this room was clearly not designed with defense in mind. In fact, medieval Polish armies focused their attacks on this room. On one legendary occasion, the attackers, tipped off by a spy, knew that an important meeting was going on here and fired a cannonball into the room. It just missed the pillar. I can actually see where the cannonball hit the wall just above the fireplace. The ceiling eventually did collapse during World War II. As I continue into the winter refectory, notice that it has fewer windows, thus better insulation, and little manhole-like openings in the floor where that central heating entered the room. I'll keep going and circle back around to where I came in. Go through the door just to the left of the stairs into the private rooms of the Grand Master. Though the Teutonic Order dictated that the monks sleep in dormitories, the Grand Master made an exception for himself. Near the entrance, I'll see his private bedroom with rough original frescoes of 4 female martyrs. Exploring the rest of the top knight's residence, I can appreciate the show-off decor, including some 15th century original frescoes of wine leaves and grapes. The Grand Master even had his own chapel dedicated to St. Catherine. I'll then enter a small hall at the very end of these rooms. If it's open, go through the little door at the right end of this hall and walk down to the Grand Refectory. This enormous dining hall, damaged in World War II, recently reopened after a decade-long restoration project. With remarkable palm vaulting and grand frescoes, the Grand Refectory hosted feasts for up to 400 people to celebrate a military victory or to impress visiting dignitaries. Now, I'll head outside. I'm back by the boiler room. So go back out into the main courtyard and walk to the top and look for the four Grand Master statues. These four statues came from a 19th century Prussian monument that was mostly destroyed when the Soviets took Melbourne at the end of World War II. Though this was a religious order, these powerful guys look more like kings than monks. From right to left, shake hands with Hermann von Salza, who was Grand Master when the Teutonic Knights came to Poland, Siegfried von Frickwagen, who actually moved the Teutonic Knight capital from Venice to Melbourne, and who conquered Gdansk for the Knights. Oops, can't shake his hand, which was supposedly chopped off by Soviet troops. Weinrich von Nipperode, who oversaw Melbourne's golden age and turned it into a castle fit for a king. And Markgraf Albrecht von Hohenzollern, the last Grand Master before the order dissolved and converted to Protestantism. To the right of the statues, continue over the drawbridge. As I cross, notice the extensive system of fortification and moats protecting the inner part of the castle. Check out the cracks in the walls, an increasingly threat to this ever-settling castle set on marshy, unstable terrain. The passage is lined with holes for surveillance, with chutes up above to pour scalding water or pitch on unwanted visitors. It's not quite straight, so a cannon fired here would hit the side wall of the passage rather than entering the high castle, which is what I'm going to do now. The high castle is the beating heart of the castle and its oldest section. As much of a monastery as a fortress, the high castle was off limits to all but 60 monks of the Teutonic Order and their servants. The knights stayed in the middle castle. Here, I'll find the monks' dormitories, chapels, church, and refectory. As this was the nerve center of the Teutonic Knights, the Teutonic headquarters, it was also their last line of defense. They stored enormous amounts of food here in case of a siege. In the middle of the high castle courtyard is a well, an essential part of any inner castle, especially one as prone to sieges as Melbourne. At the top is a sculpture of a pelican, because this noble bird was believed to kill itself to feed its young. Notice that it's piercing its own chest with its beak. It was often used in the Middle Ages as a symbol for the self-sacrifice of Jesus. I'll take some time to explore around this ground floor. Working clockwise around the courtyard from where I entered, I'll find the following. A door leads to the prison and torture chamber, with small, solitary confinement cells near the entrance and a long hall behind with a single tiny window. Along the back of the cloister is a post-World War II photo of Melbourne. Beyond that, hiding in the far corner, is an exhibit on medieval stained glass windows. Somewhere around here, I should be able to see a demonstration of how medieval money was made. The Teutonic Knights minted their own coins, and you can buy your very own freshly minted coin replica today. Continuing around the courtyard to the right from where I entered, I'll find the most interesting exhibit on this floor, and that's the kitchen. This exhibit really gives me a feel for medieval monastery life. The monks who lived here ate three meals a day, along with lots of beer that was also made here, and wine imported from France, Italy, and Hungary. A cellar under the kitchen was used as a primitive refrigerator. Big chunks of ice were cut from the frozen river in winter, stored in the basement, and used to keep food cool in summer. Behind the long table, see the big dumbwaiter with shelves, which connects this kitchen with the refectory upstairs. Step into the giant stove and look up the biggest chimney in the castle. Now go back out into the courtyard and climb up the stairs near where I first entered. Here is the middle floor. From the top of the stairs, the first door on the left with a colorfully painted arch leads to the most important room of the high castle, the chapter room. Monks gathered here after Mass, and it was also the site for meetings of Teutonic Knights from around the countryside. If a Grand Master was killed in battle, the new one would be elected here. Each monk had his own seal and a name over his seat. The big chair belonged to the Grand Master. Above his chair, notice the little windows connecting this room to St. Mary's Church next door. Church music would filter in through these windows. Imagine the voices of 60 monks bouncing around with these acoustics. While monks are usually thought to pursue simple lives, the elegant vaulting in this room is anything but plain. The 14th century frescoes, restored in the 19th century, depict Grand Masters in the floor are more vents for the central heating. Leave the chapter house and walk straight ahead, imagining the monk-filled corridors of Teutonic times. The first door on the right is the treasury. As I explore the rooms of the tax collector and the house administrator, I can notice the wide variety of safes and other lockboxes. Near the end, look for the small bed, fit for a small medieval person. I continue around the cloister. At the end of the corridor, look for the little devil at the bottom of the vaulting. He's on the right, about eye level. He's pulling his beard and crossing his legs, pointing you down the long corridor to Dansker Tower. From the devil's grimace, you might have guessed that this tower houses the latrine. For obvious sanitary and olfactory reasons, is set apart from the main part of the castle. The toilets drop straight down into the moat. The bins above them are filled with cabbage leaves used by the Teutonic Knights as toilet paper. This tower could also serve as a final measure of defense. It's easier to defend than the entire castle. Food was stored above, just in case. Head back toward the main part of the high castle. On the right-hand side of the long passage, look for a door into the church exhibition. These rooms used to be dormitories for the monks, and today they display a wide range of relics from the church. The first room features various statues, including an evocative handsless 15th century Christ praying in the Garden of Gethsemane. The next room displays pictures of various areas of Melbourne Castle, as well as some fragments of statues rescued from the destroyed St. Mary's Church. The huge mangled crucifix dates from the mid-14th century. At the end of this exhibition is a replica of a Gothic altarpiece with Gothic paintings of the murder and dismemberment of Poland's patron saint, Aldebert. Go back out into the main cloister, turn right, and continue down to the end, arriving at the Golden Gate. This elaborate doorway, covered in protective glass, marks the entrance to St. Mary's Church. Ringed with detailed carvings from the Old Testament and symbolic messages about how monks of the Teutonic Order should live their lives, is a marvelous example of late 13th century art. At the left end of the bottom of the arch, find the five wise virgins who filled their lamps with oil, conserved it wisely, and are headed to heaven. On the right, the five foolish virgins who overslept and used up all their oil are damned, much to their dismay. Go through this door and enter into St. Mary's Church. This holy site was destroyed in World War II and sat for decades with no roof. After so much neglect, it's finally been renovated. Pictures of the original church with English descriptions explain some of the fragments. I can go through the narrow door next to the one where I entered the church and hike up the tight spiral staircase to the final set of exhibits. The top floor allows me to walk through the long hallway of temporary exhibits. At the end, I can go down the stairs into the monks' common room on the left. Over the fireplace is a relief depicting the Teutonic Knights fighting the pagans. To the left of that, see the stone windows, is a balcony where musicians entertain the monks after a meal. The next very long room, with seven pillars, is a refectory where the monks ate in silence. Along the right-hand wall are confessional-like, lockable storage boxes. At the end of this room, just beyond another decorated fireplace, notice the grated hole in the wall. This is where the dumbwaiter comes up from the kitchen. Beyond this room is an exhibit about the architectural renovation of the castle. On my way back out, I'll have the opportunity to pay 8 zlotys to climb the very tight and steep steps up to the top of the tower for a view over the castle complex. The tour of Melbourne ends here. When I've finished, I can head back the way I came. En route, I can walk around terraces lining the inner moat between the castle walls. The stairs lead down off of the drawbridge. It's a pleasant walk with the Grand Master's Garden, a cemetery for monks, and the remains of the small St. Anne's Chapel with the Grand Master tombs. Pause the narrative here and begin it again as I exit the castle. Exiting the castle, I'm going to see several food stands clustered outside by the river. Maybe I'll plan for a meal, certainly have a wonderful cold beer, and enjoy this fantastic view. Also, Steve's recommends that the views of massive Melbourne are stunning, and be sure to walk out across the bridge over the Nogat River. The most scenic part of the castle is probably the twin-turreted riverside bridge gate, which used to be connected by a bridge to the opposite bank. Be sure to take advantage of this view before returning to the train station. And my return to Danzig.